Good to see everybody. Got a pretty nice crowd this morning. Be in Exodus chapter 32. If you want to find a handout, lay it around and follow along, I encourage you to do that. In the winter of 1976, may have been 77, I'm pretty sure it's 76. I was a freshman in college. That winter came a snow, 8 or 10 inch snow, and there are a lot of hills around campus. And one night, me and my buddy decided to go sledding, find some of the hilly streets around campus and go sledding. It was dark, it was already nighttime when we decided to do this, which I'm not sure the wisdom of that aspect of it, but. Anyways, so we go out to go sled. Problem was, we didn't have a sled. So that tells you how 18-year-olds think, 18-year-old guys, at least. So we're walking around campus, and there's a residence, a house right in the middle of campus. How this survived to still be a residence, I don't know, but it was still there. And from the street to the wall of the house was probably about as far as from here to that wall. So we're walking around campus, 8 inches of snow on the ground, and I look over there, and there's a cardboard box up against the trash cans. They had outside trash cans, you know, for the trash man to pick up, and this looked like a washer machine box or a dryer or cook stove or something. And it had been put there after the snow, so it was fresh, dry, and obviously trash. And I thought, there's us a sled. We'll get that box, and they won't care. You know, it's in the trash, and the trash man sure won't care if we haul off some of his trash. But, you know, something inside me was a little leery about walking onto somebody's property and getting this box. But back then, I didn't listen to those kind of things. But really, that's stealing. Their trash belongs to them, not me. All right, but anyway, I decide to get that box. So I go over there and get the cardboard box, and about the time I get there to fix and get it, the door opens, this guy comes out. And he sees me over there, and he says, "Hey, what are you doing?" And before I can answer him, he keeps talking. He says, "Are you trying to look in the window at my wife?" And I thought, good grief. You know, no, that's what I'm thinking. I'm trying to straighten this out. And he just keeps mouthing off, you know, and about me peeking in the window at his wife, you know, and I wasn't doing that. I wasn't even thought about that. And he's getting worked up, and I start getting worked up. And if I could remember exactly what he said, it probably wouldn't be appropriate to tell you. If I could remember exactly what I said, I'd probably be ashamed to tell you, so it might be good we don't remember. Anyway, he's getting worked up, and he's coming out off the porch, and my buddy grabs me and pulls me out, says, "We're leaving," and pulls me out in the street, and we go on down the street. And we hadn't been down the street far from me to the back of the room when my buddy says, "What are you doing?" He said, "Did you not see how big that guy was?" And he would have, and he described what he would have done if he'd have got a hold of me. And, you know, in our English language, we have an expression that tells us what my buddy was trying to do. And it's this: he was trying to talk some sense into me. It's those words: talk some sense into me. Okay, he was trying to tell me and explain to me how my behavior was foolish and was wrong and was not good for me. Okay, all of us have experienced that on one end or the other of the spectrum there. But have you ever tried to talk some sense into God? I would be horrified for if someone would accuse me of trying to talk some sense into God. But let me tell you what I do do. And I suspect you're the same way. I'll give you an example of when Vicki Ananassi was alive and first contracted cancer. She was here for 2 or 3 years battling with cancer before she died. And over the course of that 2 or 3 years, there were times when I would pray for Vicki. I'd be talking to God, and I would say things like this. God, she is the rock of her family. She is the primary spiritual source of her family. Her family needs her. Those two grandsons, Anthony and Elijah, they need their grandmother. They need the influence of their grandmother. And I would be telling this to God. Now, if you were to ask me, were you trying to talk some sense into God? I would say, no. I would be horrified that you would think that. If you were to ask me, were you trying to change God's mind about whether Vicki lives or dies? I would say no, because I don't believe God can change his mind. I've got all this stuff, theology in my head, you see. But if you keep putting it a little more gently and a little more tactfully, somewhere in there, if I'm honest with myself and with you, I would have to answer yes to a question. And that question might be, are you trying to get God to do what you wish him to do? Somewhere, somehow you would have to, you could ask the question where I would have to say, yes, I am. I'm trying to get God to talk God into something, to convince God to do something that it looks like he may not be going to do. Now, keep those thoughts in your mind as we go through our text for today. Let me give you a little bit of background. The children of Israel have, God has given them the Ten Commandments. We saw in Exodus chapter 20. Give them a few other case laws. And at the end of those things, he did this apparently in a way that the congregation heard them, heard him give these. Because you remember at the end of it, they were terrified. And they said, Moses, we don't want to do this anymore. We don't want God to talk to us. You know, they got way back. They said, let God talk to you, and then you tell us. Because they were horrified and terrified of the presence of God. Well, it goes on, and Moses tells them, this is what God, and this is chapter 24, you can see on your outline here, this is what God has given us. All of these commandments, all these laws, God has given us and has told you to obey them. Two times, the people said, all that the Lord has said, we will do. We'll do it. So Moses, and the text says back there in Moses in 24, I believe, chapter 24, that Moses takes Aaron and Hur and the 70 elders and Joshua, and they go a little ways toward the mountain. And apparently, everyone but Moses and Joshua stop at some point, and Moses tells Aaron, you know, we're going on. If anything goes on, you know, you need to settle matters that I've been dealing with up till now, because I'm going to be gone till I come back. So Moses and Joshua going up the mountain. Now, they were there for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, I don't know if they know prior to going how long they're going to be gone or not. But they're gone for 40 days. And the children of Israel are left behind with Aaron and the 70 elders and Hur to watch over them, to settle disputes or to make decisions or whatever for this 40 days. Well, I don't know how long you think 40 days is. But when you're waiting on someone, it's probably longer than it is if you're just your normal events of your life. And so they're there waiting. And that gets us to our chapter, Exodus chapter 32. And I'm going to read a few verses and we'll stop, talk about them, and then keep going. I'll read the first six verses. Here's what they say. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people assembled about Aaron and said to him, "Come make us a God who will go before us, for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, "Tear off the gold rings which are in the ears of your wives, at your sons and your daughters, and bring them to me." Then all the people tore off the gold rings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. And they said, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." Now when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to the Lord." So the next day they rose early and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. First point of the outline I've got, here's the heading of it. When the cat's away, the mice will play. We've all heard that saying before. Moses is gone. The people are restless. And they tell Aaron, and you notice how they say this, "This Moses guy, you know, where is he at? We don't know if he's ever coming back. Something's happened to him." They've seen smoke and fire from the mountain before, and it's probably easy to imagine that God has kind of misaimed his smoke and fire and hit Moses, and Moses is annihilated. Something's wrong with Moses not coming back. We don't know where he's at. "So Aaron, you make us a calf." And some people have suggested that Aaron, when he suggests or tells them, "Bring your gold earrings and stuff from your wives and your sons and your daughters," that he may have been trying to hit them where it hurts. You know, they say, "Well, we don't want that bad. You know, we don't want to give up our jewelry or whatever." You know, I don't know if that's so. That kind of seems a little lame to me. But they get all this gold, and Aaron, it says in this text, that Aaron makes a molten calf. Now, I don't would not be so dogmatic as to say that Aaron himself, with his hands, did all of this. I should at least say he oversaw it, he delegated, but he had it done, whether it was with his hands or he's watching some crafty guy do it. But it gets done. And they worship the calf. It says they get up and eat and drink and play. Now that's a lot can be read into that word that doesn't sound very proper, does it? But I suppose that perhaps is the case. But what do we mean when we say the cat's away, the mice will play? When someone who is in charge or more powerful than us, or that could threaten and cause us to behave in such a way because of their presence, when they are gone, then the restraints that are up on us are loosened some bit, and we are able to do things, now listen, that are in our heart that we perhaps would not ordinarily do because of their presence. Many a child has grown up to be a teenager, and they have a restraining hand upon them in the presence of their father. And when they get out from the house and are free to do what they want, all of a sudden you see them behave in such a way that their father would not approve. They would not do such a thing in their father's house. Now, some of them start trying before they get out of the house. In fact, most of them perhaps do. Okay, I speak from experience, right? Most of you are nodding and grinning from experience. Okay? Let me give you an example of how this works, not just with kids. But years ago, we had a Bible study, and I led this Bible study. It was, you know, six or eight people came to the study, and there was a man that came to the study, Mr. Bryant. It actually came with his wife. His wife, they were an older couple. His wife was a gentle Christian lady, and he was an unbeliever. He was just there to talk. And occasionally, you know, once a month or so, he would, after the study, he would get me to the side and engage me in debate. He carried his Bible with him. In the front of his Bible, he had a list of contradictions in the Bible. And occasionally he would corner me and try to debate me about these contradictions. And the first time or two that he, and I don't remember him doing it over two or three times, but at least the first time, I know for sure, that he did this, it just so happened that I had read that and read the solution for the seemingly contradiction the prior week. So it was fresh on my mind. Thank you, Lord. Right? So he tells me this, and I tell him the answer. And he says, and just shut his Bible. I could tell he was not interested in the answer. He was interested in the controversy. He was interested and enjoyed the contradictions, not the solutions. Anyway, he's there. But one week I was sick and couldn't come. And I'd been meeting with this guy, and he was a new Christian. He was older than me, but he was a new Christian. But, man, he was full of zeal and wanting to study, and he had been studying and learning, and he had started from a long ways back. He didn't have a history of being in church. But he was learning and was eager to learn, and I was last minute I got sick, couldn't go, and I asked him, could you just, you know, lead the discussion? I knew he would have his homework done. And so he said, yeah, there won't be any problem. He'd like to talk anyway. So he does. And I'm not sure if Susan went or not, but anyway, after the meeting, the next day perhaps, I was talking to him, or maybe to Susan. I said, you know, how did it go last night? He said, well, Mr. Bryant unloaded. Now, what happened? Here's what happened. I was gone, not that I'm some great authority, but I was not there. And Mr. Bryant knew enough about being around me that he knew that I was pretty knowledgeable, you know, to some extent, and all this kind of stuff. I'm not there, and here's this young guy. And he interrupts the study, from what I was told several times, changing the subject and getting out his little list during the study. Why is that? Because the inhibitions that he had, because I was there, were gone. And what was really in his heart, he was emboldened to portray upon someone he perceived as weak enough that he could handle. I think that happens all the time. In all kinds of circumstances, that happens all the time. And I think we see that here with Aaron. Moses is a strong guy. Aaron, not so much. And these people whose heart is wicked, but yet the wickedness is kept in check by the presence of Moses, well, Moses is gone. It looks like he ain't coming back. And these people burst forth with their wickedness, and now they are brave enough to let loose. And they say, Aaron, make us a calf. This Moses guy is not coming back. And Aaron is weak enough and timid enough that he acquiesces to what they want to do. He goes along with it. I've got a list of things here of restraints that are or have been on my life and your life that I think are good. Parents. Parents, for all you kids that are still living at home here, parents, God has given you parents for a lot of reasons, but one of them is a restraint upon youthful immaturity, youthful indiscretions. Thank God for your parents. Someday, you will look back and value that restraint. If you believe in your heart that your parents love you and have your best in mind, yield to their advice. Now, there comes a day when you're out on your own that you need to make those decisions. And there comes a day when your parents need to take their hands off and let you fall flat on your face. As long as you're eating at their table and partaking of their electricity, listen. Pastors. Pastors ought to be a restraint upon our behavior. And I don't mean the pastors go around meddling in your life, telling you what to do, and then seeing what you're doing, all this kind of stuff, policing you or not. I'm not saying that. I'm saying the presence of a pastor ought to be one that in some way that is a check on you and on your flesh. A spouse. It is fairly common for a, and I'm going to use a man, it could be a man or a woman, and this is certainly not the case all the time, so don't think I'm saying this or anything like that. But guys go off to some kind of business convention, and they're not around their pastor, they're not around their spouse, they're not around anybody that knows them. And what happens sometimes? The restraints are gone, and they do things that they ordinarily would not do in their hometown. You reckon that's ever happened? It has. Fellow believers, the church, there are real instances where you and I may be tempted to behave in such a way, but we restrain ourselves because I know I'm going to have to look you in the face next week. Okay? Your presence in my life, your physical presence in my life, restrains me and restrains my flesh from doing things that I might would be more strongly tempted to do. So here's Aaron. Here's the people. Moses is gone, so the people do things that they probably would not do if he had been there. Number two. And we're going to read verses 7 to 14. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, go down. Now here, let's back up a second. So here we are in the camp where the Israelite people are, and Aaron's made them this golden calf, and they're worshiping this idol. But way over here, almost like a different scene in a play. Over here, perhaps miles away, I don't know how far, but it's not just around the corner. It's I would guess, several miles away up in the mountains, Joshua has stopped and is waiting on Moses. Joshua cannot see or hear what's going on in the camp. Joshua cannot see or hear anything's going on with Moses, who goes on. Moses goes on. And up here somewhere, over here somewhere, Moses is with God. So that's where we're at. God sees and God knows what's happening back in the camp. God knows about the golden calf. Moses doesn't. Moses is just a man. God sees it all. So here we are in verse 7. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down at once, for your people, whom you brought up from the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed to it and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" And the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, that I may destroy them. I will make of you a great nation." Then Moses entreated the Lord his God and said, "O Lord, why doth thine anger burn against thy people, whom thou hast brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, 'With evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth'? Turn from thy burning anger and change thy mind about doing harm to thy people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants, to whom thou didst swear by thyself and didst say to them, 'I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and all this land of which I have spoken I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever.'" So the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people. Now, if all the children of Israel had heard that exchange, they would have said, "Whew, thank God for Moses. That was close." Let's back up and see what happened. Moses has been gone for 40 days. God sees what happens, and God instantly, I'm paraphrasing this the way it appears in our text, okay? At least the way it appears to me. God instantly sees that, and instantly he is hot. He is mad. He says, "Moses, here's what's going on over there. I know you don't know it. Now get out of the way, because I'm fixing to kill him. I'm sick of it. I'm tired of it. I'm going to kill him, and I'll start over with you." Does that sound like kind of what he's saying? Moses says, "Oh, wait a minute. Just calm down. Wait just a minute." Now, this is the heading for number 2 here. It is almost always best when cool heads prevail. You know that in your personal life. Here's God, he's hot. Moses says, "Lord, just wait a minute. Think about this. If you go down there and wipe them out, sooner or later the Egyptians are going to hear about this. And what are they going to say? They're going to say, 'Oh boy, that was just really good. What a wonderful God. He rescues you with a mighty hand. He carries you out in the wilderness, and then promptly, you're dead.' Yay for that God." Right? Moses says, "God, this is what they're going to say. This is what the Egyptians are going to say, and anyone else around who's heard this story, heard what you have done. Besides that, you made a promise to Abraham. His descendants would be as the sands of the sea. You repeated that promise to his son Isaac. You repeated it to his son Jacob. And he had 12 sons. I'm a descendant of one of them, Levi. You promised him. You're going to keep your word? Now, if we look at this text like it appears to be reading, and if we read between the lines, like we ordinarily would read between the lines in our own lives when something like this happens, then here's what God says. You know, you're right. Okay. Okay. Let me catch my breath. Let me count to 10. Okay, I won't do it. That's how it tends to read. There's a problem with that. I don't know if you've thought about this or not. You're going to have to put on your thinking cap. I don't know if sometimes when I come to church, for the first few minutes, you know, I'm still in kind of a fog, you know, from not waking up good. Are you any of y'all that way? Okay, just shake the fog out. Everybody blow it out your ears or something. Get the fog out and put your thinking cap on. Okay? You have to think for a minute. There's a bad problem with that scenario. And the problem is with omniscience. The problem is with, does God know all things? What is omniscience? There is a catechism question that we may have learned here, or my boys may have learned, I'm not sure, maybe both. The question, the catechism question is, does God know all things? The answer is this, yes. Nothing can be hidden from God. Okay. Omniscience. Omniscience means that God knows what is. God knows the present. And God knows all of the present. But it's not just that God knows the present, that God knows what is. God also knows what was. Everything about what was and what has been. God knows it all. That's omniscience. God also knows what shall be. What is coming. God knows it all. Now, I've had debates. I never could debate or discuss theology with my dad about things we disagreed on because neither one of us would yield an ounce to each other. So I just couldn't discuss things with him. Wish it hadn't been that way, and maybe if I hadn't been the way I was, we could have. I don't know. But at any rate, we discuss salvation. Sovereignty of God and salvation, particularly the passage in Romans 8, whom God foreknew, he did predestine these things. My dad told me this one time. He said, I believe that God can know what God wants to know, and God doesn't have to know what he doesn't want to know. Now, that sounds good. It gets God off the hook a little bit. But I asked him, I said, well, the problem I see with that is this. How does God know what not to know? See? Before he can, and the idea was, if he doesn't want to know anything about whether or not you're going to be saved or not, then he doesn't, just says, I don't know that. Well, how does he know what not to know? In other words, for him to not know something, he's got to know it, not to know it. All right? So that doesn't work. It doesn't work. But there's something else about omniscience that we need to get a grasp on. And this is a little hard. You see down there about four or five lines up from the bottom. I got some statements. God has always known all things. The next one, God has never learned new knowledge. And let that sink in. God has never learned new knowledge. The next one is a little tougher even. God's knowledge cannot increase by reason or logical progression of thoughts. I know it, me too. Now think about this. I think things through. Okay? I'm looking at this problem and I'm trying to see how to solve it. And I know if I can figure out this one thing, that'll give me information to take the next step to figure out something else. So my knowledge is progressive by use of my reason. God doesn't learn like that. No. God doesn't learn like that. God doesn't figure out the first step and then see to the go to the next step. That's what I kind of assume. I mean, I know better, but I kind of catch myself assuming that sometimes when I pray. God, this needs to happen. Would you do this because this is what's going to happen if you don't? Tell you a story. I may have told some of you this story, and you might think, I don't know what you're going to think about the story, but that's all right. Years ago, probably 30 years ago at least, I had a friend that had a little boy, 3 years old. He was probably a year or two younger than my boys. And this man and his wife split up. The man was a Christian man. He hadn't always, been a faithful Christian, but at that period of time he was. But his wife was evil. She openly exposed her older children to sexual perversion. She was evil. Just did not care. And they split up, the little three-year-old boys going back and forth, what the arrangements were between one and the other. And he was word sick about when this little boy was with her. But he was with her one time, and she just up and took off, moved out. He went to pick up the little boy at where she was living, and she was gone. The man that she was renting, whatever it was from, so he didn't have a clue, where she went. They were just gone. And so over the course of other things, and I can't remember exactly how, but it somehow had to do with a dog. They had cared a dog, and the dog apparently got away from her or something and had a tag and a collar that had his phone number on it. So he gets a phone call from some dog pound in Colorado and found the dog. So now he thinks, at least she's in Colorado, I guess. Anyway, to make a long story short, she's gone. And he's worried sick about his three-year-old son, what his three-year-old son is being exposed to. And me and him used to meet every week. He went to church with me. And we used to meet every week at church in the morning and pray. Once a week, I think it was. And I can remember the church had two steps up on the stage, just like we've got here, and we called this the altar. All right? And we would meet at church. We could have sat back there and prayed or whatever, but we came here and prayed. And I can remember distinctly having my head down on this altar, praying for this three-year-old boy. I was saying, God, protect his mind from what he's probably seeing and being around. God, get him out of that situation. And I was pouring out my heart to God. And it was as if God reached down. He didn't. But it was as if he reached down and got me by the hair of my head and pulled up my head. And he said, "Who do you think you're talking to? You think you are so compassionate that if you were me, you'd do something about this, wouldn't you?" And all these things went through my mind, and I don't know how long a period of time. It seemed like 5 minutes, but it probably was 15 seconds. And I was just choked on my words. He said, "Do you believe I could deliver him?" And, of course, in my mind, I know he can. But I don't. I haven't. Why not? You would, if you were me. Are you more merciful than I am, do you think? I don't know how long that took, probably 5 seconds. All I could say eventually was, "God, I'm sorry. I'm sorry." Thinking, trying to convince God to do something, to show mercy. You know, God never told me anything else. I mean, never gave me thoughts other than, "You are God. I hurt for this kid, I hurt for this dad, but you are sovereign over our lives." God knows. God knows all things. All of God's other attributes correspond and interrelate to this necessary attribute of God, His omniscience. Every other attribute of God works through and among, is related to, is affected by this attribute, that God knows all things. So why does it look this way in the text? This isn't the only place. Why does it look this way in our text? We've talked about this before. God has to condescend to us so that He presents Himself to us in terms that we can understand. I cannot, with my finite mind and my fallen reasoning, I cannot ascend to the knowledge and the depths of the understanding of the Almighty God. He must communicate with me in ways I can understand. And that's what we see happening not just in this text, but in other texts in the Scriptures as well. God's actions. I want you to just think about this last sentence on this page. God's actions and what we see it said about God here shows us the standard of God's holiness, that His expectations for those people, and God's immediate, even though we can't put time on God's actions or knowledge either, His immediate response to a violation of His holiness and His righteousness. And we see God's holiness And we see the importance of righteousness from our lives, from our perspective. The back of the page, going to number 3. Here's the statement. It is possible, but very rare. It is possible to have a hot head in a righteous manner. Now, I'm not talking about God here anymore. We're going to be talking about Moses. So let's read our text starting in verse 15 through verse 28. So now, God's changed his mind according to Moses. And God has said, okay, I won't do it. So Moses turns to leave. And he's going away, going back down the mountain. And we see in verse 15, then Moses turned and went down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony at his hand. Tablets which were written on both sides. They were written on one side and the other. And the tablets were God's work, and the writing was God's writing engraved on the tablets. Can you envision that? I had a thought. I imagine if you looked on the internet somewhere, somebody got those things for sale. Reckon? You could probably buy 3 dozen of them at a cheaper rate. What would it be like to have a stone that actually was written and engraved in that stone was engravings that God himself supernaturally put there? What would it be like to possess that, to have it on your shelf at home? I don't know. But Moses is coming down from the mountain and he has these tablets. Okay? Verse 17. Now when Joshua, he gets to where Joshua is at, waiting on him. When Joshua heard the sound of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses. So they're getting close enough, they can start to hear some noise. Joshua says, there is a sound of war in the camp. They're kind of interpreting the kind of sound that they're hearing and say, what is that? Verse 18, but he said, it is not the sound of a cry of triumph. If it's a battle or if it's a battle going on, it doesn't sound like you would think it would sound if they were winning. Nor is it the sound of a cry of defeat. It doesn't sound like that. He says, but the sound of singing I hear. This is probably the first karaoke. Reckon? Some impromptu stuff going on down there in the camp. Verse 19, and it came about as soon as Moses came near the camp that he saw the calf and the dancing, and Moses' anger burned. And he threw the tablets from his hands and shattered them at the foot of the mountain. Every picture I have ever seen of these broken tablets is just two pieces. Okay? But you can look up the Hebrew word here, and it says it's burst, like a shattered windshield or something. He threw them babies, didn't he? He threw them, and they burst into a lot of pieces. And he took the calf, verse 20, which they had made and burned it with fire, burned this calf with fire, ground it to powder, and scattered it over the surface of the water, and made the sons of Israel drink it. Okay, now what goes on, you can see what it says. He ground this golden calf into powder. He ground up this gold into very fine gold dust, and he throws it in the brook or wherever their water supply is. And when they get water, they're going to be drinking this stuff. Okay? So, go on. Verse 21. Then Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you have brought this great sin upon them? And Aaron said, do not let the anger of my Lord burn You know the people yourself that they are prone to evil. For they said to me, make us a God who will go before us. For this Moses, the man who brought us from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And I said of them, whoever has any gold, let them tear it off. So they gave it to me, and I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. Verse 25. Now when Moses saw that the people were out of control, for Moses had let them get out, or Aaron, excuse me, had let them get out of control to be a derision among their enemies. Then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered together to him. And he said to them, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, every man of you put his sword upon his thigh and go back and forth from gate to gate in the camp and kill every man his brother and every man his friend and every man his neighbor. So the sons of Levi did as Moses instructed, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. Moses is hot. He comes down from the mountain, he sees what's going on. He just talked God out of this, God's anger, right? He gets down, and now he sees what's going on, and he understands a little bit better. And he is instantly angry. He throws down the tablets, he grinds up the calf, throws it in the creek, and he finds Aaron. Now there is, this event is told from Moses' perspective later on in the book of Deuteronomy chapter 9. And the details that are there are not contradictory at all, but there is an added piece of information in Deuteronomy chapter 9 that you don't see here. And that added piece of information is, to me, important. Somewhere in this mix, between the time Moses comes down and sees what's going on, and Moses goes back to the mountain, we're going to see at the end of our chapter here, to ask God for forgiveness for them. Somewhere in there, Moses fasts for 40 days. Okay, he's mad. When he comes down, he's mad. Now, my heading for this point was that it is possible to have a hot head in a righteous manner. The Bible warns us against being angry. But Paul also says, be angry, but sin not. Jesus, we are told, was angry when he threw the money changers out of the temple. But it was not a sinful anger. I want to go through just some thoughts here. On this topic, you see the third bullet point on the back page. Who does Moses confront and hold most accountable for what went on? Aaron. What excuse does Aaron give? How is Aaron's explanation different than what we just read at the start of this chapter? Okay? We read at the start of the chapter, it's almost like Aaron is, yes, talked into it, but he is wasn't too hard to talk him into. He's a willing participant to help them along the way they're wanting to go. Now, when he explains this to Moses, it sounds a little different to me. He says, first of all, Moses, you know how hard these people's heart are. You know what they're like. You know you have to keep your thumb on them all the time. You know what they're like. And they told me, and he gets some of this right. Now, let me give you a definition for an excuse. An excuse is a skin of a reason stuffed with a lie. There are some things that Aaron says that are true. There's just enough truth to it that he thinks it justifies his behavior. He says they're hard to get along with. They're evil. You know, they're prone to do all this kind of stuff anyway, and they thought you weren't coming back. Where were you, Moses? Why'd it take so long? You think I could handle all this by myself for 40 days? And they told me to make this calf, so I made this calf. And I took all their gold and wadded it up in the ball and threw it in the fire, and here's a calf. Is that what happened? I don't think so. Somewhere in here, Moses is hot. Should I say still hot? Where is it that Moses fasted in this scenario? I think, and this is just my guess, doesn't tell us. I think it is right here. Moses comes down, and he has a righteous anger. Perhaps throwing the tablets down wasn't a manifestation of the righteous anger. He grinds up the calf, gets rid of that, and he gets in Aaron's face. He says, "What in the world are you doing? What could have happened that would have convinced you that you fell into this?" I think Moses is hot right there. But somehow, somewhere in there, Moses fasted for 40 days. And I don't know, this is just my guess, but I'm just telling you the events that happened here. Somehow at the end of that 40 days, Moses is acting in a planned out, instructed manner from God. And when Moses comes back, he says, "Here I am. Here's the line in the sand. Who is with me on the Lord's side?" I think there have been 40 days for people to think through what has been going on here. It doesn't tell us, and I don't tend to believe that it is necessary that all 2 million of these people participated in this. Perhaps they did, and that's okay. God can handle all that. But I think perhaps it would not violate the text that it was a large group, we know it's a large group, fix to see that were involved in it. But everybody that knows about it has had 40 days to think through what's going to happen here. And Moses comes up and he says, "Who's with me?" I think God has instructed Moses to do that. The people have had 40 days to repent of what they have done, or to remain obstinate in their decision. The Levites, and maybe he was just talking to the Levites, that he came and said, "Who's with me?" Maybe he's talking just to that particular tribe, maybe not, I don't know. But the Levites come, and they're there. And I believe that Moses then tells them to do what God told them to do. Take your sword, go through the camp, and kill them. Kill who? I believe the ones who refuse to repent, the obstinate ones. 3,000 men were killed that day. A lot of men. It's a lot of blood. A lot of blood. Now, does that sound harsh? Yeah, that sounds rough. But you need to remember one thing. Not worshiping God in a proper manner was already prescribed as a capital offense. God has already told them. God has already warned them. If you don't do this the way I tell you to do it, you will die. Did these 3,000 men get mercy from God? No. Did they get injustice from God? No. They got exactly what God said they would get. I've got a statement here. God has a long history of being merciful. Did you know that? That's kind of a rhetorical question, isn't it? God has a long history of being merciful, even in the Old Testament. Even in the Old Testament. Now, number four, and we'll be through. Though Moses loved these people, here's the point, though Moses loved these people enough to die for them or with them, he could not remove their sin by his willingness to suffer in their stead. Let's read the last verses, starting at verse 29. Then Moses said, so here's all these 3,000 dead people, and Moses talking to the rest of the people who are there. Dedicate yourselves today to the Lord, for every man has been against his son and against his brother, in order that he may bestow a blessing on you today. Dedicate yourself to God that he may bestow a blessing upon you. And it came about on the next day that Moses said to the people, you yourselves have committed a great sin. And now I am going up to the Lord, and perhaps I can make atonement for your sin. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, alas, this people has committed a great sin. They have made a god of gold for themselves. But now if thou wilt, forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from thy book which thou hast written. Now let's stop right there a second. Moses goes back up to the mountain and he says, God, they've sinned. These people have sinned a great, a grievous sin. I'd like to ask you to forgive them. Now don't read this way. Don't read this as if Moses is saying, God, if you ain't going to forgive them, then forget me too. No, that's not how Moses is saying this. Say, God, please forgive their sin. I ask you, forgive them of this great sin they have sinned. And if that's not what you will do, then I ask you to do this. Let me take that sin upon myself. Spare their life, but kill me. Take my life instead of theirs. The Apostle Paul said something similar to that the first few verses of chapter 9 in Romans that we looked at a year or two or three ago. Moses is willing to take the punishment from God upon himself if God will spare the people. Moses loves these people. Now, notice what God's answer is. The Lord said to Moses, verse 33, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. But go now, lead the people where I told you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I will punish them for their sin. Then the Lord smote the people because of what they did with the calf which Aaron had made. Now, there's a lot of things here, there's information here that's not here, and we don't know. But there is one thing that comes out. God is telling Moses that there one man cannot receive punishment for another man. No, I'm not talking about Jesus. I'm talking about I cannot take Don Tibbett's sin and satisfy God's sin or judgment against Don. I can't do that for Don, even if I wanted to. And I don't. I can't do it because I got problems of my own. Right? I got enough punishment of my own I'm worried about. Okay? God said, no, it won't be that way. And somewhere, somehow, in some way, to some extent, their sin follows them. There are consequences for our sin. We may not experience it like that. It haunts us. It follows us. And yes, we can deal with it. Yes, we can experience a joyful forgiveness. But still, there are times when it rears its ugly head. I was told that the Jewish people have a saying from this day in our text forward, that when they experience the judgment of God, they would say this: in every judgment of God, there is an ounce of the powder, gold powdered water from Mount Sinai that we drink, acknowledging that that sin 4,000 years ago still walks with them.